So welcome to this roundtable event on Palestine and international justice at the LSE. I'm Kirsten Ainley from the International Relations Department here and also Director of the Centre for International Studies at LSE, which is hosting the event with the generous financial support of the Department of International Relations. The Centre is home to an interdisciplinary community of scholars from around the globe who are undertaking innovative research with an international dimension. And we welcome applications for visiting fellowships. So if any of you are academics who have sabbatical or practitioners who would like to take some time in an academic institution, please do check out the website of the Centre for International Studies or contact me for information. So the format of the event tonight is as follows. It is a CPD-accredited event. I've left some forms for any of you who use the self-accreditation forms near the door there, and there's a form to fill in here at the end of the event if you'd like to do that, so just let me know at the end of the event. So the format of the event is as follows. Each of the roundtable participants will speak for 6 or 7 minutes. I'll then open up to the floor for comments and questions and periodically refer back to the panel for their answers to the questions and further views on the issues under discussion. Let me say something very briefly about the subject matter before I introduce our speakers. So on the 31st of December last year, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas signed the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court on behalf of Palestine. On the 1st of April this year, so in just a few weeks' time, the Rome Statute will enter into force in the Palestinian territories, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. By making a declaration under Article 12 of the Rome Statute, Palestine has sought to backdate the jurisdiction of the court to the 13th of June last year, which was the start of Israel's military operation against Gaza. Palestine has promised or threatened, depending on your view, to refer complaints to the court immediately on the 1st of April this year about the 2014 incursion in Gaza, about the occupation of the West Bank, and about Israeli settlement policy. And it will request that the ICC investigates these with a view to bringing prosecution. Now, it can't force that, but it can request that the court looks into these situations. The Office of the Prosecutor has taken early steps towards investigations by beginning on the 16th of January this year a preliminary examination into the situation in Palestine. Now, Palestine's decision to join the International Criminal Court has provoked a range of reactions, from celebration to outrage, from despair to resignation. It may have influenced Netanyahu's recent renunciation of the two-state policy, could even have influenced the results of the Israeli election yesterday. And Palestine's move to join the court certainly raises a range of important questions, including why has this decision been made now? Is the request to join the ICC about politics, or is it about justice and accountability, or some combination? What are the implications of Palestine joining the court for Palestine, and what are the implications for the court itself? What are the implications with the peace process, for the peace process with Israel? And how likely are we to ever see trials at the ICC of either Israelis or Palestinians? Now, we've gathered an illustrious group of speakers tonight to address some of these issues, and I will introduce them very briefly in the order in which they'll speak, but I encourage you to look them up on the web and look up their publications. I'm not going to list them here because there are a lot of them. I'd rather hear them speak than talk about them, but I encourage you to look them up. So Dr. Chantal Maloney, who will speak first, who's a lecturer in international criminal law at the University of Milan and a visiting researcher at the Humboldt University in Berlin. After Chantal, Dr. Michael Kearney will speak, who's a lecturer in law at the University of Sussex. After him, Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, who's an associate professor in international relations and co-director of the Centre for the International Politics of Conflict, Rights and Justice at SOAS, the University of London. Then Dr. Mark Kirsten, who is a postdoctoral researcher and the founder of the blog Justice in Conflict. Followed by Dr. Dov Jacobs, who is Assistant Professor of International Law at the Grotius Centre of International Legal Studies, Leiden University, and blogger at Spreading the Jam. And finally, Professor Kevin John Heller, who is Professor of Criminal Law at SOAS University of London. So Dr. Maloney will kick us off with 6 minutes or so on some of these issues. Let me hand over the microphone.
Yeah, what a difficult task to start this incredible rich panel, but thank you so much, first of all, for the invitation, and please bear with me, I'm not English mother, native speaker, so I'm not able to speak as fast as Kirsten is, so but just in case I'm not able to make all my points now during the 6 minutes, there will be another round of comments, so hopefully it will be enough time. Well, let's start by stating something that is probably obvious to some of you, that it, it is that until not long ago, the idea itself to use international law and international justice with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was mostly a theoretical exercise. In fact, until almost a decade ago, the issue did not reach the docket of international courts and tribunals. And to some extent, this was for sure because the institutions themselves did not exist previously, or otherwise because they were not available to the Palestinians. In fact, until recently, and consequent to the uncertain and legal status, not only Palestine could not ratify the statute of the International Criminal Court, but it also could not accede to international instruments as a human rights law instrument or international treaties as the Geneva Conventions, the Torture Convention, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, just to mention a few of them. And consequently, not only the jurisdiction of the ICC, but also of human rights committees, such as the Committee Against Torture, was difficult to extend to the Palestinian territory. As we know, and as we have heard, this is no longer the case. Over the past 10 years, by the way, both the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court have been confronted with aspects of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And to understand how dangerous is perceived by Israel and by its allied states, the possible recourse to international law mechanism by Palestine, we can remember the incredible amount of pressure that was put on the PA, on the Palestinian Authority, at the time of its first UN bid, so to say, in 2011, when some Western states, as Italy, as the UK, conditioned their support for the resolution at the UN, a favorable resolution for Palestine, to the fact that Palestine refrain, and I quote here, something that was leaked to the media, refrain from applying for membership of the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, which could both be used to pursue war crimes charges or another legal claim against Israel. So, of course, it is very unfortunate that international law, human rights law, and more generally the rule of law are subjected and sacrificed in this way to the political considerations. And at the same time, the fact that political considerations are an integral part of international law, including international criminal law and international justice, is not surprising. And in the case of Palestine, these can be very well noted looking at how the ICC, the International Criminal Court itself, handled the situation so far. After the so-called Operation Castled, I don't know, I guess you remember about that, in January 2009, Palestine made a first attempt to accede to the court and activate the jurisdiction of the prosecutor of the ICC. In the person of the then Minister of Justice, at that time, January 2009, it lodged a declaration accepting the jurisdiction of the court under Article 12.3 of the Rome Statute, which gives the possibility to also to non-member states to accept the jurisdiction of the court ad hoc. And this declaration was done retroactively from July 2002. I don't know how many of you remember what happened in the following months. There was a UN fact-finding mission on the Gaza conflict that issued in September 2009 a report that was very detailed and comprehensive. It was named after the president of the commission, so the so-called Goldstone Report, that was outlining the commission of crimes by both sides, but in particular by the Israeli side. And as Richard Falk put it, the Goldstone Report broke the sound barrier. Why? Because the fact that the UN had established such a high-profile mission to investigate and document allegations of war crimes committed by Israel marked a novelty in the politics of the UN towards Israel. But in particular, I think the importance of the report led in these very precise recommendations, which emphasize the need for accountability measures, including the recourse to International Criminal Court and other justice mechanisms, as the UJ principle, universal jurisdiction principle, before third states courts. The report was endorsed at the UN level, at the Human Rights Council, of course, at the General Assembly, also at the European level, and triggered the whole process, which lasted for more than 2 years and included the establishment of a committee of experts with the task to evaluate the internal investigations. And with regard to Israel, they concluded that they were not effective. At the same time, the opposition of Israel and its allied states and their political pressures to block and minimize the report's impact within the UN and other fora, as the International Criminal Court, meant that the fact-finding mission powerful recommendations remained ineffective. What happened with regard to the ICC? So in 2009, after the ad hoc declaration, the prosecutor had opened a preliminary examination. And it took almost 3 years to the Office of the Prosecutor to arrive to the conclusion that the office was not in a position to open any investigation because it could not decide whether Palestine was a state or not in international at the international level. And as it was well noted by several commentators, this was not the only option for the prosecutor at the time. According to Professor Pellet, for instance, and many other renowned international law professors, a functional interpretation of the concept of statehood would have been possible for the court at the time, without any need to decide once and for all if Palestine was a state or not under international law, but only for the sake of the jurisdiction of the ICC. And by the way, it is well known that the concept of statehood is one of the most complex in international law and that it's basically a matter of bilateral relations among the states. So, and here I conclude because I finished my time for now, maybe we can. The prosecutor, however, decided at that time, in 2012, to kick the ball directly to the UN. And this paradoxically created an effect that boosted a reaction at the UN level, so that the UN General Assembly in November 2012 upgraded the state of Palestine at the UN General Assembly, which now is a non-member state, and this means that now Palestine is recognized, at least by the ICC, as a state, and this is what led to the possibility to ratify the statute in January. I stop here. Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much.
Michael Kim. Okay. Yeah, thanks for the invite. It's great to be back at the LSE. I guess when the Palestinian Authority, when Mahmoud Abbas did declare that he was going to ratify the Rome Statute and join the International Criminal Court back on New Year's Eve of 2014. I was quite interested in the nature of the response in the weeks and month or so afterwards. A lot of commentary around the issue, you know, discussed the types of issues that Kirsten raised in the introduction. Was this a diplomatic ploy being played by the Palestinian Authority? Was it a political challenge of some sort to Israel? Was this the Palestinian Authority taking steps to promote and to secure justice for the Palestinians? Was it a strategy aimed at securing further recognition or assertion of statehood? Or was this move some sort of ploy again, or some strategy that had to do with the peace process? As such as the peace process might be. My feeling along what I felt was absent from the analysis was that, well, first of all, each of those issues, I think, to suggest that Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority were thinking in that direction is to give them far too much credit. I think that my conclusion basically is that the reason the Palestinian Authority joined the International Criminal Court was a result of internal Palestinian pressure, that Palestinians, whether they were human rights NGOs, civil society, popular public opinion in general, or whether it was political factions across the Palestinian spectrum, Palestinians basically wanted to see every step or every action possible by which they could seek to protect and promote their human rights utilised. The record of the Palestinian Authority when it comes to using international law and the institutions of the international legal framework has been pretty consistent. There was the kind of spectacular turn to the International Court of Justice by means of an advisory opinion back in 2003, where the court in 2004 gave an opinion saying that Israel's construction of the wall in the West Bank was unlawful. The follow-up, I don't know if anyone's aware, what did the Palestinian Authority do to follow up on the conclusion that the wall was unlawful? They pretty much didn't do anything, okay? In 2009, Chantal mentioned the fact-finding mission report known on the Gaza conflict, known as the Goldstone Report. The Goldstone Report was submitted to the Human Rights Council at the United Nations. It was withdrawn from the agenda of the Human Rights Council by Mahmoud Abbas himself, okay? It was Palestinians reacted to this. They were very upset, obviously. And the report was only discussed at the Human Rights Council because the Council agreed to establish to put in place an emergency session in order for the report to be considered. With respect to the ICC and the question of statehood, when the Palestinians first made a move to the court in January of 2009, my understanding is that that was a mistake. The Minister for Justice of the Palestinian Authority went to The Hague. He did not have the permission of the European Union or Israel or the US or any other actor. As far as I understand, he did not have the full permission of Mahmoud Abbas or the Palestinian Authority either. Okay? I was working with a Palestinian NGO called Al-Haq, based in Ramallah at the time, and we started... basically, this was something we'd been pushing for, okay, that Palestine should attempt to join the International Criminal Court to seek accountability for war crimes and crimes against humanity. We began advocacy work on the question of statehood. Was Palestine a state? This was something that had never been on the agenda of human rights organisations. It had never been on the international agenda in any way, shape or form, okay? The only reason this General Assembly declaration recognising the state of Palestine came about in 2012 was because the Palestinians, I would say mistakenly, going to the International Criminal Court, put the question out there. When we started advocating on the issue and dealing with the question of statehood, we got representations from people within the Palestinian civil service saying we shouldn't really be doing it, okay? Basically, for us as NGOs and human rights activists to start talking about Palestinian statehood, to suggest that an international judicial body has the capacity to determine the borders of a Palestinian state would be to undermine the negotiation power, the diplomatic power of the Palestinian Authority themselves, to negotiate with Israel as to what those borders might be in the future. Okay. Of 1 minute, why did the Palestinians join the International Criminal Court? Basically, Mahmoud Abbas had tried to put it off as long as he possibly could, and he did put it off for 5 years. He'd set himself a deadline, he'd set the international community a deadline, and he basically said, if I do not get a Security Council resolution agreeing to a timetable by which Israel must end the occupation, then I have no other option but to go to the International Criminal Court. Okay, so when Nigeria decided to support the Israeli position and the Security Council resolution didn't happen in December, that is why Mahmoud Abbas joined the court. And I would suggest that is basically a result of successful human rights advocacy from Palestinian campaigners. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. First of all, can I say thank you to Dr. Ainley for inviting me to speak on this panel and also for putting this together. As you, I'm sure, all know very well, Dr. Ainley is an expert on the International Criminal Court herself and so could easily have just given the entire panel. So thank you for having us over once again. I've been tasked with answering two and a bit questions. I'm going to frame them as two. One is, why now? Why has the PA made this bid to join the ICC at this stage? And secondly, what are the implications for the peace process? And I'm going to answer the why now question very quickly, but in a sort of more short-term way than my two colleagues who have preceded me. So let me just mention a series of motivations. And I should say that my analysis of this, I have done interviews in Palestine, but not since 2008. So most of my interpretation of this is based on secondary research and one primary interview, which was off the record with one of the legal advisors to the IDF. So why now? First of all, to leverage and piggyback on the post-Gaza, and I mean 2014, the post-Gaza legitimacy crisis that faced Israel, and I think there was one relative to previous events, the legitimacy crisis that faced Israel with respect to its public opinion in the United States, in Europe, and in the region. So I think this is a key motivation in terms of explaining the exact timing. The short-term triggers, the granting of observer status at the UN was clearly a necessary but not a sufficient condition. The failure of the UN resolution in December was, of course, clearly a very important short-term trigger, but I would point to very specifically that I think this is important perhaps in demonstrating that there was a division within Europe and that this created the prospect for the Palestinians to leverage the charge of hypocrisy against Europe for not backing its interest in joining the International Criminal Court, since, of course, that is a very important part of a European position. So the split within Europe in terms of that Security Council resolution vote, I think, was actually very important in the short term as a trigger to making this, paving the path for this sort of possibility. In terms of the motivation with respect to the peace process, clearly this has been in part driven by the desire to force a two-state solution through the mechanism of internationalizing the crisis. Central part of this has long been a bid by the Palestinians for statehood. This is not new, but this is perhaps a different stage in the strategy. Why the International Criminal Court as a mechanism? I see this as a bid to seek international legitimacy, again, in part, but by no means solely through this mechanism of dividing and pressing the Europeans, and there are people in the audience, especially Anthony Dworkin, who have written quite a lot in this, I'm hoping will come in on the question of Europe, because that's less my expertise. In terms of the specific motivation of less obvious motivations on the part of the PA, and I thought you might be saying some of the things that I was going to say, but I think you took a slightly different angle. I am very interested in the internal Palestinian politics. I don't have any way of confirming the motivation, but I have some suspicions, but they potentially point in different directions. Was this, a bid by the Palestinian Authority to strengthen its power within the unity government, which was formed in April 2014? Is this pitched potentially at weakening Hamas, who could very likely be a target of an ICC, future ICC investigation, and my colleagues will say more about that, I'm sure. Or, alternatively, could this have been motivated by a desire to increase the legitimacy of Hamas and strengthen the unity government so as to make it more of a credible partner in international negotiations? How could it increase the legitimacy of Hamas? Because Hamas, regardless of what it really feels, has come out and said that it's very supportive of joining the ICC. So there's a potential legitimacy play there. At a minimum, there's an assumption, I would imagine, on the part of the PA that the ire of the ICC would not be directed at Hamas, but it would not be directed at itself, but would be instead directed either at Hamas or at Israel. So in a sense, it's a very cheap and easy move. An obvious motivation that I think has been more commonly articulated by those who study the ICC and international justice, but which I give very little credence to as a motivation for this bid, is that this was driven by a desire to deter Israel from committing atrocities, especially in Gaza, or to seek accountability. Unfortunately, for better or worse, I really don't think this had very much to do at all with a decision to seek membership. And so that there's a much broader conversation to have there about the politics of the International Criminal Court. And to answer Dr. Ainley's very first question, I think this is clearly pretty much entirely about politics, but not divorced from questions of legality and legitimacy and how they factor into questions of politics. So in terms of the implications for the peace process, a couple of words. A caveat, of course, is this the right metric? As we know, in some ways it's unfair to come down where I probably will come down, because it's rarely the case in any cases that we look at of ICC intervention and ongoing peace process, in cases where there is an ongoing peace process, that on its own terms, as an independent factor in isolation, that the ICC has dramatically altered the nature of a peace process. It rarely has. Another caveat, the prospects for the peace process, I mean, really, we know they're grim right now. So to pin it on the ICC, especially as of this morning, would be foolish. So let me say a couple of words in 1 minute or less about motivations, and I guess I will focus on the U.S. since I only have a minute. The U.S. reaction. The U.S. clearly opposed this move. It's, as we know, threatened to withhold assistance to the Palestinians, labeled this as provocative and many other things. The U.S. has placed a priority on peace over accountability or justice, and through to the extent that it's placed any priority on a peace process, it's been through domestic processes, not international organizations like the ICC, trust building and negotiation. The U.S. wisely will be aware that this makes its key role in the peace process harder and not easier. What's its key role? Delivering Israel to the table. This makes it very, very hard, much harder for the U.S. to do that. And so the PA has, in a sense, created another headache for the United States. The United States will find it increasingly difficult to turn a blind eye to Israeli atrocities, and this makes the job of getting Israel to the table no easier and possibly harder. Given that there was a shift in terms of the U.S. response to Israel during the summer Gaza war, and I think that there was a degree of a shift, it isn't clear to me that the ICC move has proved effective in driving a wedge between Israel and the U.S. Clearly, other things have over the past several weeks, but the ICC move, I don't think, has, and in fact, it could have served to driven the United States and Israel much closer together. Am I out of time?
You are.
Okay, so my last sentence would be that, in fact, what I think this will do to the peace process is to reinforce, if not accentuate, the hierarchy of power politics between Israel and Palestine. I can say more about that. Thank you.
Very much. Mark Christie.
Thanks very much. I'm going to talk as well about and exclusively about what I think the potential impact of the ICC on the peace process might be. But I think before I do that, I think it is important to warn against catastrophic or overly optimistic hypotheses about what the ICC can do. I agree completely with Leslie that both hypotheses, that the ICC would destroy or save the peace process, give the ICC a potency it simply does not have. It can't single-handedly ruin or save peace negotiations. And second of all, I think it's important to realize and contextualize the peace process as being one of that's in protraction. So neither side can really give up on the peace process entirely. They always kind of have to keep it alive, even if it's struggling. And so the question for me is not whether the ICC will save the peace process or whether it'll ruin the peace process, but rather how it'll change the context in which the peace process goes forward. And my argument is basically that it's all about the conflict narrative. So it's all about changing and challenging the storyline in which this peace process is taking place, what Noah Feldman has called the framing of the conflict, and the storyline in which we understand the peace process and the actors involved. Every conflict, of course, has some kind of dominant narrative which tells us or attempts to tell us who's right and who's wrong, who's the victim, and who's ultimately responsible. We tend to look at these in terms of binaries, of one side being good and the other side being evil. Until recently, and I think we have seen a, a significant shift in this. The Israel-Palestine conflict has been seen within this context and has been presented within a broadly speaking dominant narrative that is relatively easy. It's pitted Israel as the legitimate, democratic, and good side against a Palestine that has elements which may want to annihilate Israel and which is basically a breeding ground or something like that for terrorism, as thus the evil side. And Israel, I think, has been historically, at least, very good at ensuring that this is the primary narrative in which we understand the conflict itself. And specifically, I think, the Israeli government has been extremely successful at creating and ensuring that there's a narrative where, again, it sees itself as a liberal democratic barrier to Palestinian aggression, constant potential Palestinian aggression, and therefore that Palestine needs to be checked, it needs to be at least in part occupied, and periodically there needs to be incursions in order to prevent further damage or further aggression by Palestine. Secondly, broadly speaking, that Palestine, and not just Hamas, but Palestine as kind of an entity, is a breeding ground for potential terrorism and is itself a constant threat, not only to Israel, but to the rest of the world. And thirdly, that Israel is in a unique and exceptional geopolitical situation that at times can place it above international law and above international pressure. And I think we see this come out clearly in Israel's recent the Israeli government's recent campaign against the International Court in response to a potential referral and a ratification of the Rome Statute. Its reaction has basically been that the court is sponsoring terrorism and is acting at the behest of terrorist organizations in Palestine, and also that the court will undoubtedly unfairly target Israel and basically Israel alone. There's been no mention from Israeli government officials about the reality that Hamas is likely to come under ICC scrutiny as well. And of course they can't do that, because to admit that the ICC would look at Palestinian factions would admit that this conflict narrative isn't as crystally clear and asymmetrical as they would like you, or that they would like to present it to be, and instead there'd be something mutual about responsibility in terms of injustices and crimes committed on the Palestinian territories. And so I think this reaction fits perfectly, actually, within this dominant narrative. So put together, this creates a vastly asymmetrical conflict narrative that constitutes the backdrop in which the peace process takes place. And it's in this context, I would argue, that Palestine's decision to refer itself to the ICC must be understood. It's an attempt or a desperate means to kind of try to level the conflict narrative a little bit and, again, take advantage of what Leslie called the legitimacy crisis that I think Israel may be facing, which at its core is challenging that very conflict, that very asymmetrical conflict narrative. And I think it's amazing, actually, to realize, and it's unprecedented, that this is the first time an entity which is considered the bad or the wrong side of a conflict has referred itself to the ICC. This has never, as far as I know, happened. So given all this, how could the ICC intervention potentially positively affect the peace process? To conclude, I want to talk briefly about three possible ways I think that this could shake things up. First of all, it could help establish a certain degree of shared responsibility for the conflict. It would challenge and change the, it could potentially challenge the asymmetrical narrative at the core of the conflict into one in which there's a better factual, forensic, and moral basis on which to declare and on which to understand that both sides are responsible for a tremendous amount of suffering and a tremendous amount of injustice and potentially international crimes themselves. To put it another way, and to evoke William Sartman's idea of ripeness, it could create a situation where there's more of a mutually hurting stalemate or a recognition that they're mutually responsible for the situation that Palestine finds itself in. And secondly, it could potentially raise the costs of non-genuine and non-conclusive peace negotiations. Right now, I think it's clear that nobody really wants an ICC intervention that ends up in arrest warrants. The ICC probably doesn't want it either. And the best way to get out of this situation is for some kind of judicial activity or decision-making between Israel and Palestine. Could they set up or could they negotiate some kind of judicial mechanism together that would investigate alleged crimes? Perhaps, perhaps not. But doing nothing right now will virtually guarantee, maybe not 2 years down the line, maybe not 5 years down the line, that arrest warrants will essentially have to be issued on one side of the conflict. And thirdly, it could potentially raise the costs of international inaction and apathy towards a comprehensive peace agreement. Here, I think it's particularly interesting to recognize the lack of a role of the United Nations Security Council. But I think it would be interesting if the UN Security Council did get involved and got more directly involved. And I think at least it's interesting to consider the potential that the UN Security Council could get more directly involved. And this might be one of the very few situations in which an Article 16 deferral of an investigation or a prosecution by the ICC could occur without being castigated by the human rights community. So again, I would just say there is potential, I think some positive potential for the ICC to help break the protraction in the peace process, at least to rattle the status quo of the peace process, and to increase the costs of letting a peace process that to date has been basically moribund the last few years to not remain moribund. Thank you.
Thank you. So I join the others in thanking you for the invitation. It's nice to be back. Actually, this discussion makes our Syria discussion like a walk in the park,
yes.
Kind of. So I rather ambitiously aimed at addressing three points, so I'll try and get through them. If not, I'll have time during the discussion. The first point was the generous strategy of Palestine, and it's been touched upon by Chantal and the first three speakers, actually, Michael, Leslie. I think that the two main issues which came out from what they said, and I think are important to actually distinguish, is the quest for search for statehood, and a term I'm going to use, which I know at least two panelists here don't like anymore, is lawfare. So just one word on the quest for statehood. Now, the ship has sailed on the 2009 declaration. I disagreed with the functional interpretation at the time. My argument at the time was, you're a state, a state that can do a 12-3 declaration is a state that can join. Simple argument. And I'm not saying Palestine was not a state back then, but I think it, by many definitions of statehood, it could have been considered a state, but that the differentiated approach to statehood in general and 12-3 was, I don't think, very convincing. But I think that it's a complicated issue, because as Chantal said, theories of statehood are a bit complicated in a horizontal, international legal order. So there's not one institution which has a power, as you would have domestically, where you're attributed personality by the law. There's not this one institution which gives you statehood. So you have this combination of political statements, of recognition, of joining certain IOs, etc. And in that sense, I would qualify what Chantal was saying, is that Palestine cannot join the ICC because it's a state. Joining the ICC is one more step in that quest for statehood for me. It's because the General Assembly vote is legally irrelevant. I mean, it's not even a status that exists in the UN Charter. So it's just an adding up issue, which ultimately would lead to this legitimacy of statehood. Again, possibly it is already a state, but I just wanted to say that. On lawfare, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, just to be clear. I just say that it's a traditional meaning that you use law to put forward political aims. And clearly, the human rights agenda, using delegitimizing your adversaries through claims of war crimes or allegations of mass atrocities, is, I think, a legitimate strategy. And so joining the ICC has this parallel approach. So it's statehood and the lawfare to delegitimize the adversary. I think this has an impact in the peace process, but maybe we come into that later. Okay, I've actually reversed my points because it makes more sense. What can we expect from the court itself to do in this case? Now, I think Kevin is going to talk more about the crimes, etc. But very briefly, I think there are three issues to consider. One is jurisdiction, two is complementarity, and three is cooperation. So very briefly, jurisdiction, theoretically, someone could challenge this. Again, there's not this clear internationally recognized document saying Palestine is a state. So you can always imagine a challenge. It won't come from the OTP because the OTP itself has said the General Assembly resolution is determinative, so the OTP would not say anything. But you can imagine if a case comes, someone would raise a jurisdictional challenge. I mean, it's possible. I think that ship has sailed, to be honest. And we won't see a jurisdictional challenge on that basis. On complementarity, it can be quite a mess because, Israel might be very reluctant to use its judicial system, but it has one. So Israel could very much put in place, if it wanted to interact in that level with the court, enough procedures to stall any investigation going forward to opening a situation. Even from the Palestinian side, it's actually a tricky situation, because if cases are opened against Hamas, then what does Palestine say? Yes, that's true, we have no judicial system, it's corrupt, it's ineffective, that doesn't look good. But then it might be forced to prosecute its own population, which won't look good internally. So I think that that didn't necessarily lead to a big conversation internally, the consequences of complementarity here, at least symbolically. And the third point is cooperation. Again, everybody says the basic thing is that Israel won't cooperate. That's most likely. But it could turn out to be a kind of cooperation nightmare for Bensouda, because let's say Israel cooperates only on allegations of Hamas crimes, because they probably have a lot of information. What does Bensouda do? Just say, well, you're only providing information on one side, I won't use it, which would say that she's not looking for justice, that she's being political. Or she could say, I'm going to use it, but then she'd be criticized for only using the information against one side. So again, I think this could be quite... If Israel cooperated, it could create more problems in that sense. Now, this leads me to my last point, again, in the short... I don't know, I've spoken very fast. Maybe I have more time than I expect.
You've got a minute.
Okay, so no, that's perfect. I tried.
Be careful what you ask.
So what does it mean for the court? Now, in a nutshell, it has been put forward as this idea, this opportunity to get out of Africa. I've seen this several times in blogs, etc. I think it's a really wrong road out of Africa. As I said before, it's going to be a procedural nightmare. Every difficulty the OTP has had in the past is going to combine in one situation. For some reason, Bensouda is really vocal about wanting this. I mean, she had this, what I find strange, op-ed in The Guardian saying, I really want this, which I found inappropriate, but anyway. So I think it can be a nightmare for the court, and I'm going to self-plagiarize myself, if I may. It's no point paraphrasing myself, but... When Palestine joined the court in January, I wrote a blog post, and my conclusion was that it would be a big test for the court. And that in the case of Israel-Palestine, including the usual challenges, that there's always an additional drama when you talk about Israel and Palestine. If the ICC messes up, I use a different word in my blog, this one, it could have serious consequences for the institution. What scares me is that history has unfortunately showed that there doesn't seem to be a way not to mess up when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which means that, at the risk of sounding dramatic, the ICC will now not only have to prove all the usual suspects of critics wrong, but will have to, in fact, prove history itself wrong. A daunting task. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. And last but not least...
Yes, it's no fun going last, but it's actually kind of fitting because I think, my predecessors have focused on the politics, and I would say I'm focusing on the law, but I'm not really focusing on the law because I don't actually think the ICC will ever open a formal investigation into Israel-Palestine in the first place. And so that's really where I want to start. No matter what people think, they seem to think that the ICC is somehow eager to leap into this most politicized conflict of the 20th and 21st century and suddenly start applying blame to both sides. And I'm going to be very, very surprised if the ICC ever opens a formal investigation. And I don't mean that because the situation doesn't deserve to be investigated. I think it's clear that it's one of the gravest situations in the world. But I don't think we take the ICC's institutional interests into account enough when we try to prognosticate what it might do. And I see very little in it for the ICC actually opening an investigation. And Dove has touched on a couple of the things. But the first consideration is they don't have the resources to investigate too many more situations. To say that they are overstretched as it is a considerable understatement. I happen to know for a fact that for about a year, there was only one analyst working on the Georgia preliminary examination, and it was a 23-year-old recent graduate of the LSE. Now, obviously, they have superpowers, those who graduated from the LSEs, but that was literally the only person working on the Georgia situation for about a year. So the idea that they can all of a sudden just dedicate a vast amount of resources investigatorily to Israel-Palestine, I think is not very compelling. So you have to ask, would they spend their limited resources on this situation as opposed to all the other potential non-African situations? And again, I think the answer is really no. They have shown, public pronouncements aside, very little desire to wade into situations where there are major superpowers watching their behavior. If you think about the Afghanistan investigation, in which the United States is conceivably subject to the court's jurisdiction, they're now in the eighth year of their preliminary examination. If you look at Georgia, where you obviously have Russia sitting on the sidelines, they're now in their sixth year of their preliminary examination. The OTP knows how to slow walk a preliminary examination into oblivion, and when we're talking about major superpowers, that seems to be what they want to do. And if you think about Israel-Palestine, you know, the United States has become a lot more helpful to the ICC over the past few years, as my friend Mark has probably written more intelligently than anyone else. And whether they want to risk alienating essentially everybody in the world by investigating the situation, I think is an open question. And then the other consideration is the one that the Dove mentioned, which is the cooperation issue. And I think this is a serious problem, because Israel could absolutely prevent the ICC from effectively investigating, particularly in Gaza. Yet they would be more than happy, I think, to help investigate Hamas crimes. We've seen the same asymmetric cooperation from a variety of states. You just think about Omar al-Bashir. He has stonewalled the court at every turn, but when the OTP decided to go after some rebels for attacking UN peacekeepers, they were more than willing. Like, you want some tanks, you want some soldiers, here, we'll happily, you know, escort you into Darfur. So there's a real danger of de facto, if not de jure, making this a one-sided investigation into Hamas. And I think that would be very problematic legally, but I think it'd be even more problematic institutionally for the ICC. So I don't think we're going to see an investigation. How much time do I have?
You have 3 minutes.
Oh, I have 3 minutes. Wow, I'm talking fast in my American way. I do want to say a few things, though, about, you know, I'm not always right. So if there was a formal investigation, what can we see? And I think here my sympathies are very much on the Palestinian side, but I think there's a lot of reason to suspect that a formal investigation would not turn out quite as well for the pro-Palestinian side as many people think. I have on very good off-the-record discussions that the preliminary examination is really focusing on Gaza. It's not focusing on the West Bank. Now, not saying that it wouldn't morph into that, but they seem to be focusing on Gaza. And if you're focusing on Gaza, and again putting aside moral, normative, whatever claims, and really focusing on the law, if you're a rational prosecutor, and my friend Michael might disagree with me about this, if you're a rational prosecutor, it is Hamas's firing of rockets that is the easiest of all of the crimes in Gaza to prosecute. Maybe not the most grave, but absolutely the easiest to prosecute from a legal, evidentiary, and cooperation perspective. So I would be not surprised at all if the first charges, not to say the only, but the first charges were brought against Hamas. And I think there are some definitely Israeli crimes that might attract the court's attention. I do think we see qualitative differences between the most recent operation and Operation Cast Lead. We certainly do have cases for willful killings and intentional attacks on civilians where there you have individual soldiers picking off people trying to help their fallen comrades. But again, from a legal perspective, I think most people immediately go to disproportionate attacks. Well, come on. All the attacks have to be disproportionate, and I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. But again, international criminal law is not international humanitarian law. It requires a level of specificity and things like mens rea, for the lawyers out there, that are not always easy to prove. And disproportionate attacks, and I've written quite a bit about this, it is one of the absolute most difficult to prove war crimes in the Rome Statute. Under international humanitarian law, all you have to show is that a reasonable military commander would have viewed an attack as disproportionate. But if you're going to charge a commander with a war crime, you have to prove that the commander subjectively concluded that, in fact, it would be disproportionate. So really, and I'm not exaggerating here, unless the commander of the IDF says, there's absolutely no point to this attack, it's going to kill lots of civilians, but screw it, I'm going to do it anyway. Really, anything short of that is not enough to prove the war crime. So we can talk politically about all of Israel's crimes, and again, I don't have an issue with that, but proving them in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt according to the elements of crimes in the Rome Statute is very different. So as far as Gaza goes, I would be very, very unsurprised if it was Hamas going first and Israel kind of being left for later, if it's even possible to investigate them to such an extent that you could develop a strong criminal case. So I think to conclude, perhaps the best of all possible worlds is precisely for the OTP to slow walk this preliminary examination into oblivion. Because I really do think that there is a symbolic value to Palestine ratifying the Rome Statute and making it opening itself up, and Hamas opening itself up to prosecution without ever actually being prosecuted. I do think that among many of the states, particularly in Europe, it does matter that Palestine has ratified the Rome Statute and Israel is simply stonewalling the court. So maybe the best situation of all is for Palestine to kind of milk the benefits, as my colleagues have said, of that decision without actually ending up being formally investigated and prosecuted. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to stand rather than mess about with the microphone. This is a round table and we invite contributions from the floor. It's not the easiest room to have an open discussion in, given that you're back like this. But what I'm going to do is ask for contributions, ask you to identify yourself and your affiliation or your institution, and to make comments or questions to keep them reasonably short. I don't want to have to hold up my post-it to tell you a minute left. But if you would like to hold up your hand and indicate whether you would like to ask a panelist a question or make a comment. Yeah, Anthony, why don't you start us off?
So I'm Anthony Dorkin, the European Council on Foreign Relations. Leslie's already kind of cued me to talk.
Sorry.
I'm going to talk about Europe, as you asked. But actually, the main sort of thing that I wanted to suggest is that the political framing that a couple of you have used about, you know, is this going to help or hinder the peace process? I'm going to suggest an alternative political framing, which is to, you know, wonder whether, not necessarily motivated, but in any case, the ICC move kind of fits in or takes its place against the context where the salient question is, should we move away from the peace process towards another approach? And I think we see this under consideration both in terms of external supporters here, principally Europe, and actually a kind of interesting debate among the Palestinians themselves. So from the European point of view, you know, Chantal is absolutely right about the reaction last time, and even in the run-up to this time, there was quite a strong pushback from the Europeans. But in fact, the European response, kind of post the Palestinians joining, has been very, you know, very moderate, very restrained. There hasn't really been a lot of European response. And I think partly that's because it would just be too hypocritical for the EU, which campaigns so strongly for universal adherence to the ICC, to try and punish the Palestinians.
Everybody.
But I think it's also because there's a real debate in Europe about whether, you know, the peace process continues to be the best way forward. And I think there's an alternative that they're looking at, which is to shift to more of a kind of legal, rights-based approach, getting away from the politics of getting everyone around the table and looking more at putting pressure on Israel through measures such as, I mean, it's the BDS agenda, you know, boycott, divestment, sanctions, in particular, you know, moves against products coming out of the West Bank and so on. And so I think, you know, there's a sense in Europe among some policymakers, there's a big European investment in Oslo, but maybe it's time to give up on Oslo because that agenda is getting nowhere, and that, you know, is only confirmed by the re-election of a Prime Minister who's effectively said that he's not interested in seeing a Palestinian state. And I think you actually see a parallel today on the Palestinian side with, you know, actually a kind of generational thing where Abbas is probably on the wrong side of this. He was, you know, as Michael said, really back in very reluctantly to joining the ICC. But I think there, you know, there are quite a lot of people within the Palestinian side who think it's time to give up on the peace process and pursue a much more rights-based approach and more sort of civil disobedience. You know, okay, we're going to accept that we're under Israeli occupation and, you know, we want our rights as an occupied people rather than we want to get rid of the occupation through negotiations.
Thanks, Anthony. Chantal, do you want to make a very specific point on
if
that?
If I may, it's just to, because it's really related to this point, and I think it's something that is missing maybe in the picture, so it's helpful for the discussion. Before ratifying the ICC statute this January, the Palestinian government decided after the UN resolution in November 2012 to ratify 16 or so a number of the most important international humanitarian law and human rights treaties. Among these, the Torture Convention, Genocide Convention, the Geneva Conventions, and so on. And this was done in 2014. And I just want to read what the spokesperson of the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights said about this. This accession to seven core human rights treaties, this was specific to the human rights treaties, and key protocol is a significant step towards enhancing the promotion and protection of human rights in Palestine. It is notable in a region with a high number of reservations to human rights treaties that Palestine is acceding the 8 human rights treaties without making a single reservation. So this just to say that Palestine, when ratifies an international instrument like this, takes obligations, that is, I also have to respect this with regard to my own. We'll see if they will do it. But at the same time, this has been called by Israel, not the ICC accession, but the ratification of the human rights treaties, literally as blackmail. Blackmail. And Palestinians from their own side said, here again I quote, that they can no longer rely on negotiation to end Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and they decided these ratifications as a paradigm shift, exactly what you said, and they would pursue other means in parallel with peace talks. Well, don't let me start to say what I think about the peace talks.
I'm going to try and take a few more questions or comments from the audience before turning back to the panel to both respond to them and also to your questions and points. So I can see, yes, up there with the green tie, please, and then I'll
take. Hi, I'm Avi Manigal, a lawyer of the city. You all indicated that we shouldn't hold out much hope of this ratification leading to a peace process, and I think that's probably right. Do you have any thoughts or information on whether post-ratification there has been a decrease in violence or in particular forms of warfare between these two sides? If not a peace process, do you think the ratification of the Rome Statute could potentially lead to temporary peace, a certain form of peace? And do you think that that is an institutional effect that the ICC might be expected to have in this instance?
Okay, thank you. Let me take at least one more. I'm going to take one here and then one right at the back and then add and one over here, I think, and then I'll come back to the panel. So I'm going to try and remember all of those. So here, then the back, and then the gentleman over there.
Hi, my name is Oded. I am a new member in the council of an organization called the World Federalist Movement, which served as the coordinator of the coalition.
Can you speak up a little?
The World Federalist Movement was the organization that coordinated the International Coalition for the Criminal Court of the Civil Society. And I come from Israel, and we think now of setting up a coalition of Israeli organizations and Palestinian organizations that of civil society that will try to help this move of the Palestinian Authority and the ICC to have a beneficial impact on the conflict. So I would like to hear the panelists if they have any recommendations for the strategy of how civil society can help bring beneficial results and not what's the worst case scenarios that we just heard. Thank you.
The question right at the back.
Yeah, thank you to all the panelists. To pick up on Anthony Dworkin's point about rights-based approach, I wondered if the panel had any comments on the idea that there's a contradiction at the heart of the rights-based approach. Because on the one hand, it seems that Palestine wants to be a state for the procedural purposes of getting to the ICC. On the other hand, it wants to be occupied territory for the purposes of prosecutions at the ICC, whether it's in relation to settlements, for example. And yet both of those require effective control. The estate, the Palestinians have to show they have effective control, but to be occupied territory, they have to say that it's Israel that has effective control. So I just wondered if anybody had any thoughts on this contradiction about who has effective control for the purpose of occupation and for the purpose of state and what that meant for the Palestinian rights-based approach.
Okay, could you just identify yourself as well?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I'm really new at SOAS.
Thank you. And there was another question over here.
Yeah, Richard. My question is, you mentioned how, like, if the cases were being taken forward to the court, that Hamas would probably be the one that's mostly prosecuted. don't you think that would fuel more conflict in the sense that Hamas would notice that they are being identified as a criminal? Don't you think they'll pull back and then use more conflict?
All right, thank you. So I'm going to turn back to the panel here. Some excellent points raised on the panel and in the questions. Let me go back in the order that you presented and just ask you to take a couple of minutes to respond either to points raised by the audience firstly to points raised by the audience and then to points raised by each other if you'd like to do so. So let me start with Chantal. Although you've got less than 2 minutes because you jumped in before.
Okay. fair enough. I'd like to respond to this last point, which also... involves Kevin, what you said, because not that I want to contradict you, but I'm coming from The Hague, and I had interviews yesterday with the Office of the Prosecutor and the people that are in charge of the preliminary examination, and in fact there are 5 people at the moment working on this. The prosecutor, the CCD section of the Office of the Prosecutor doubled in the last month, so they have new staff and a lot of capacity. And they are focusing both on the West Bank and Gaza, definitely. And the settlements are a big issue on the table of the ICC that will be taken very seriously. I don't believe at all that it is... impossible that the ICC will open an investigation. On the contrary, I would be surprised of the opposite. And of course, they will investigate also Hamas responsibilities, but this doesn't rule out that they will investigate the Israeli responsibilities. Then Israel will never cooperate. Okay, we can go forever and say, where will they stop? We know that there are practical obstacles, but the investigation, I believe it will start.
Just kind of group together Anthony and Ode. Yeah, I mean, civil society, human rights, okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about the rights of the individual. And I'm going to jump from this to Kevin's analysis, which I think is really important. What are we talking about? We're talking about the rights of the individual, okay, that all people are of equal value and, you know, we're against discrimination, right? We're in a situation in Israel-Palestine, regardless of who controls the territory for external purposes of international law or international institutions, where there's discrimination between Jews and Palestinians. That's built into every aspect of life. Regardless of whether the ICC exists or not, what we should all be pushing for is equality. I guess a lot of you saw the film Selma, which was out over the last few months. You know, I watched that a few weeks ago and I was like, I've seen that in the West Bank, I've seen that in Gaza, I've seen that in Israel. That treatment between the white power and the black disenfranchised. I've seen it in Palestine, right? And with respect to the power relations. So as civil society, particularly Israeli and Palestinian, right? There's already so much work going on between Israelis and Palestinians to promote human rights. Obviously something we need to encourage. On the question of effective control as a criteria of statehood, Chantal's mentioned, you know, that, and a few of us have mentioned that the idea of what is a state and what are the criteria for statehood in international law. It's a mess. There are no criteria as such. It's a political determination. So I would say that the idea that for Palestine to be a state, that it needs effective control, I would say that it's been proven that you don't need effective control on the basis that Palestine has been recognised as a state already. What Kevin has been saying, I think, is really important in the sense that the ICC, yeah, it might go and just investigate and prosecute Palestinians, in which case, where does that leave us? I'm going to suggest, from a Palestinian perspective, that would mean just the continuation of what's been happening to Palestinians for the past 70 or 80 years. Subjugation, dispossession, destruction of their culture and their land and their heritage. And if the ICC fails them, it's so what? Then life and the struggle will continue. I think it would say a lot more about the ICC than it will about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and a lot more about international politics than specifically about just this one conflict either.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, I have a couple of reactions to the questions. To the gentleman in the back here, somebody asked the question, whose behavior will this change, ICC oversight? And I suspect that the biggest impact will be on Israeli behavior with respect to different mechanisms introduced into the advocate general's office and in terms of embedding legal advisors into the IDF and so on and so forth. And we've already seen some of this. So I think it will change Israeli behavior with respect to some sort of oversight. Whether that actually changes operations is a different question, but I think that's the biggest change we see. And that's, you know, intended. I mean, I think that's a double-edged sword, right? And I think that there's there's internal conflict within Israel about what's really motivating that as well. So I don't think we can entirely dismiss it. Katrina's question is, of course, fascinating question. It's exactly right, but I think it comes so deeply from a legal scholar, a lawyer. I don't want to be dismissive, but I think that I think what's driving the Palestinians is much more pragmatic than, you know, whether or not, I'm sure that they're intelligent enough to recognize the conundrum of, you know, different bodies of law and the game that they're playing not being consistent from a legal perspective, but I don't think it really matters because I don't think it's about a legal motivation. I think it's about a political motivation. And, you know, this, I mean, as somebody who comes at this from the perspective of politics, I'm always befuddled by this. Is it a state? Is it not? I mean, you know, it's not a state. But it's sort of moving in. I mean, I completely agree with the person who said this is a mechanism to become a state. And so I don't think the ICC and the question of, you know, which crimes could it get accountability for is at all what this is about. So I think it's a really interesting problem, but it's a problem for the ICC and not really for the Palestinians and the regional conflict, although it clearly could have an impact. And then Antony's comment. I'm very intrigued by this, and I'm marginally persuaded, and I think it's definitely worth several, you know, articles and pieces, but I don't think it's quite right. I think it's a little bit too drawing a line in the sand, right? The human rights approach, the human rights law approach, the sort of sanctions, right? South Africa under Thatcher, well, not Thatcher's support, but, you know, during that period. It's also, if you think about, you know, if you follow the support from Europe and the U.S. and its vagaries and its oscillations with respect to Syria and the ICC, you could even, you know, if you cut in at one point in time, you could say, oh, you know, given up on diplomacy and it's now hardline sanctions backing the ICC. And then, of course, we're not in that game anymore now. When we were on this panel on Syria and the ICC, I think we were somewhere in that game. It was sort of, you know, the rise of ISIS. But we hadn't gotten to where we are now. So I think, again, it's going to be much more pragmatic. I think that there's going to be a blend. And, of course, you could say that it's a mechanism for bringing, you know, as the context changes, for bringing the U.S. back into the peace process that the Palestinians are playing and that the Europeans are playing. And if you don't bring the U.S. back into this game, then, you know, nothing's going to move one way or the other. So at some level, whichever strategy the Europeans are playing, not to quote Bob Kagan, who I disagree with on so many things, pretty much everything that matters, except for his basic line, which is, you know, the weapon of the weak, law and human rights. It's the weapon of the weak. And in this game, Europe is actually quite weak, right, with respect to actually moving this challenge forward. And so what is it going to take to shift things back towards a context where the peace process, if there, you know, becomes serious again, has a lot, why is it not serious again? I guess was the question that came up in my mind was, one is domestic politics in Israel, clearly, and then the U.S. priority on negotiating a deal with Iran, which make it unsustainable in the context of current Israeli politics to talk about a peace process in which the U.S. is engaged, so long as that Iranian deal is, you know, on the table in the way that it's being framed right now. So, and then ISIS and everything else. So I think if you begin to think about that context changing and Hillary Clinton perhaps being president, and she would, I think, get much more behind a peace process, then I think you might start to think that actually the human rights approach is, you know, only integral to a broader strategy. So I suspect if we get together in 2 years, this is going to look very different.
Thanks, Leslie. That's plug for the next American president.
Yeah. Firstly, I guess the same point. I'm intrigued by this idea too, but just thinking out loud, I suppose. I mean, what's the precedence of peace without a peace process or the exhaustion of war? Right? Is there precedence for resolving interstate or maybe intrastate conflict like this through law and rights? I'm not sure, but it'd be interesting to look at. The other thing is, and this is one of the reasons why it's so protracted, is the investment of the United States for so long in this peace process. And it'd be very difficult to imagine the United States allowing it to not be a peace process. The words peace process were established by the United States to describe the negotiations they were making between Israel and Palestine. The idea that it could be resolved outside of how the United States wants to see it resolved seems difficult for me to imagine. But at the same time, I like this idea of them functioning in parallel, or it seems to be an interesting idea. And I think it's clear, quite clear, that for the moment, if not forever, the Oslo peace process is dead, right? I mean, what did Netanyahu say the other day, right before the election? I'm sorry, but if I'm elected prime minister, there is no Palestinian state. I will not negotiate that again, because to do so would allow for another breeding ground of radical Islam. The decrease in violence or the change in behavior, I think this is interesting. This goes to, I guess, somewhat of the deterrence argument, which I think, like Leslie, that it's very questionable. It's very difficult, obviously, to prove. I think it's possible, after the Goldstone report, there was a decrease. We haven't seen the use of white phosphorus in Gaza, so there was some change in behavior. But at the same time, again, this week, Netanyahu has declared that he will go forward and build more settlements, irrespective of whether the ICC is looking into that as a potential criminal issue. And then just to respond for the ICC, how what would this mean for the ICC? I mean, technically, in some sideways way, it could be very good for the ICC, I think, because as Kevin mentioned, the ICC can only do so many cases, and so the best way for the international community to ensure that the ICC doesn't intervene fully in Palestine is to keep it busy. So enforce arrest warrants, get Omar al-Bashir into the dock, and the ICC won't be able to spend more resources anywhere else. And internally, I think there's actually more of a struggle. I agree that this is about institutional interests, but I think there is more of a struggle. I think individuals within the Office of the Prosecutor want to be involved. And there's a tension that, yes, they don't want to get mired in the most politically contentious peace process ever, but at the same time, I think they are somewhat interested institutionally in being involved in one of the most contentious peace processes ever, because it suggests a certain gravitas or relevance of the court if it manages to get involved in the stickiest situations. That might not ultimately be good for a court without enforcement mechanisms, but it makes it look like a really relevant and important institution, and that is one of its interests, I would argue. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Yes. Okay, a lot of points, again, difficult to cover them all. I think I didn't get a memo where we don't use the word lawfare anymore, because you're all describing it, and you all publicly say you don't like it, but anyway.
I like it.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm still going to use it, because I think it's useful to describe the strategy even from a human rights-based approach, etc. So just three short points. One, statehood, again, in a nutshell, as an international lawyer, I'm amazed at how much we've made believe as international lawyers that this is a legal question. Now, and I know there's a lot of politics in international law, but for me, this is not a legal question. Statehood is a political fact. And the fact that Crawford wrote a 600-page book on this, that it's being discussed, it's a big scam from international lawyers. Don't trust us. It's not a legal question.
So now he's on the ICJ.
Yeah, well, that's a different problem. On the rights-based approach, I agree with the idea that it's not a clear line in the sand, and also the idea that the legal order or the legal framework that applies is not necessarily that relevant, as I think Leslie said and Michael said, question of equality. But I just want to pick up on this lawfare dimension of it and this idea of narrative that Mark said. I agree with what Michael said about the failure of the international community towards the Palestinians. But I think you're missing the double-edged sword that is lawfare in terms of human rights, is that, you know, you're playing on the legitimacy of stigmatizing the other side as a human rights violator, and you forcing yourself to respect those rights. You know, you're entering this minefield of human rights. So it's not as simple as the international community failing the Palestinians. It's also that. But when Hamas go on TV during Gaza saying, we're aiming at civilians. You know, I mean, Kevin's point that it's an open and shut case for the prosecutor, that's not a question of failing the Palestinians. It's a question of Palestinians going on TV saying they're targeting civilians and then joining the court. And it's a double-edged sword. It's the same with human rights. I mean, when I saw that Palestine joined the UN corruption treaty, I mean, come on. You know, it's putting them in front of their own responsibilities. And that's not a bad thing. But we can't see it on just one side. Lawfare is you're entering a new narrative field, a new narrative of the conflict, which can affect you as well as the other side. And just on the decrease of violence, there is a deterrence question, but it's also, again, a question of narrative. And Kevin pointed out how hard it is to prove proportionality. The violence decrease depends on how you view Israel's conduct. You know, the idea that there are evil people sitting in an office saying, let's just kill civilians, if that's accurate, you might see a decrease in violence. But it's more complicated than that. Leslie already mentioned legal advisors, but it's been there for a while. That's what makes things complicated, you know, is that there are legal advisors who are specialists in IHL. There are, except if you can prove a general policy, and there's a Dayan policy that's been discussed for many years, or crimes against humanity policy, except if you can prove a state policy, then I'm not sure you'll see a decrease in violence based on what I know, because the Israelis do claim that they do a proportionality evaluation in a case by case. They claim that they have stopped attacks in certain cases. Now, if that's true, again, I'm not saying it's true or not true. If that's the case, then you won't see a decrease in violence because they're already saying they're doing things right. So that's the final point for me for the moment. Yeah.
Thank you. And Kevin.
Good to go last again. So a number of things. I mean, first off, I thought I was clear. I am not saying that Hamas will be the only side prosecuted. I'm saying that a rational prosecutor would go after Hamas first. And I think that would put a lot of pressure on the prosecutor to do something on the Israeli side as well. And what I think is very interesting, and I'll say it very provocatively, but I mean it very seriously, that, and this gets to your point, Hamas is not unaware of their vulnerabilities with the Rome Statute. And they've obviously gone through an internal process where they've decided that the risk is worth it. And I think if they were really smart and they really wanted to get a formal investigation going, they would pursue, and this is the provocative part, they would pursue what I would call legal martyrdom, where they would literally offer themselves up to be prosecuted first. And there's not exactly precedent for this, but there's close, because every time that the ICC goes after government officials and rebels, the rebels cooperate. Abu Garda in Darfur flew to the court, appeared at every hearing, and was eventually let go. If Hamas really believes particularly that what they're doing is legitimate, then if you really want to put the prosecutor in an untenable position where she absolutely has to open an investigation and eventually go after Israeli crimes, let Hamas offer themselves up first. Other point I want to make is, and this is also in the be careful what you wish for category. I mean, let's imagine that the court does actually go after Israelis, and let's imagine that they're acquitted. And anybody who thinks that any Israeli crime that is prosecuted is going to result in a conviction has not been following the ICC's record of futility. And the mountain is much higher to climb with Israel, given the difficulties of investigating and the lack of cooperation from Israel. So it is very, very plausible that any Israeli prosecuted will be acquitted. And the impact of that is something to keep in mind as well. And then the final point that I want to make, my beloved colleague's point, I agree on the effective control issue with both with Dov and Michael that this is a political issue. And so I just want to flag, well, we're going to be asking an international criminal court to make the first real binding, in any way, decision about whether Palestine is a state. If you think the ICC's judges are relishing the idea of deciding whether it's the Montevideo criteria or it's recognition, they cannot want to do that. And they may have to, because if any Israeli who's ever dragged before the court is going to challenge precisely that issue. So it's murky. And again, I don't draw any lessons from that. I just want to highlight the irony of asking an international criminal court to make the decision as to whether Palestine is a state, and do we really want them to be doing that?
Sorry, can I just add something on that? In terms of first times, I didn't mention it, but what also might come up is that the ICC might end up being the first to define the borders. Because, you know, there's territorial jurisdiction, there won't be nationality jurisdiction. So if there's a settlements issue comes up, you know, where's the line? East Jerusalem, where is it? You know, if the ICC has to say we have jurisdiction or not, they might have to decide from a judicial perspective where the actual borders of Palestine are, which again would be interesting. Yeah.
We have a short amount of time. I can see three hands at least. So I'm going to take those three questions. And anybody else who wants to ask a question, then do put your hand up. So over here, then towards the back, and then right down at the front. And then I'll go back and I'm going to let Kevin go first to see if the panelists have a comment at the end. So yes, please.
The discussion by Dr. Kirsten about the framing of the conflict and the fact that there was this good and bad side, I guess, where does Hamas's role in that fit in the context of potentially increasing its legitimacy and the things that they can do, potentially using warfare to try and manipulate the situation, and just, I guess, talking to that point?
Okay, thank you. Did you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, I'm Tanya, and I'm from here.
Thanks, Tanya.
Hi, I'm Caleb Wheeler. I'm a PhD researcher at Middlesex University. A lot has been said about the ICC perhaps being unwilling to take up the tough questions involved in this, and obviously there are a great number of tough questions. But what is the point of the ICC if at some point they don't take up tough questions? And, you know, it seems to me that if it is ever going to be a court, a truly legitimate body, it has to start dealing with tough issues, or it becomes totally irrelevant. And so I'd like the panel to address, you know, at what point does the ICC sort of draw a line in the sand and say, we are going to decide this, because if we don't, really no one's going to take any attention to it.
Thank you very much. And then the final question down here, unless I see any other hands.
Doris Carrion with Chatham House. So my question is for any of the panelists, and it moves beyond the ICC and international legality of statehood, but it's maybe about other forms of lawfare that we might see popping up. So last month, a court in New York found the PLO and the PA liable for acts of terrorism committed against Israel, or against Israelis during the Second Intifada. And I would just be interested to know if any of the panelists would like to comment on that and perhaps explain context a little bit and see if they could envision any scenario in which a Palestinian might choose to present a case in an American court against an Israeli
opponent. Right, thank you, and I did see one more hand, so
yeah, Vivi. Yes, thank you. I'm indeed a PhD student here in the Department of International Relations. Thank you very much for the really interesting panel. Maybe as a last question, I'd like to kind of redirect attention again to the court and kind of what this means for the court itself, because obviously we've discussed a lot of the motivations behind the Palestinian side.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes. So, sorry, I'm a bit sick. So, on the one hand, kind of I appreciated it's come up again and again on the panel in terms of the institutional image and perception. Doug mentioned kind of the out-of-Africa idea, so the perceptions of the court, what this may mean in terms of kind of geographical shifting in terms of the court's own positioning. Also, Kevin mentioned kind of institutional interest, which then I appreciate the mark picking up. And so I'd kind of like to give that back to the panel, because many of you are privy to kind of inner workings, the politics within the organs of the court, particularly the Office of the Prosecutor at this moment in time, and kind of what that means for the court itself against the backdrop of the kind of commentary of kind of peaks or spades of crisis or perpetual crisis the court finds itself.
Thank you. Thanks very much for excellent questions. So let's go. You all have a standing one-minute warning.
I'll try to be quick. So I'm going to start with the first and the fourth question, because I completely agree that at some point in time, the ICC has to have a claim to be relevant, or it's just going to become another meaningless international institution. But I also would insist that they have to be smart about their road out of Africa. And I don't think the road out of Africa is to Palestine. I gave a lecture. That's true. I gave a lecture at the Service Prosecuting Authority a couple of weeks ago. They asked me to come in and try to explain to them how ICC preliminary examinations work, because, of course, the Office of the Prosecutor has restarted the investigation of UK detainee abuse in Iraq. And to me, that one's got the ICC written all over it. It would be taking on the United Kingdom. The UK would have to cooperate because they are a member of the court. And it's costless, because no British soldier is ever going to end up in the dock at the ICC. If it ever got to charges, the UK would step in with its very advanced military justice system and would prosecute the person. So if you want a road out of Africa, it leads much more directly to the UK than it does to Palestine for me. And I do think we're going to see, I do think Bensouda wants to get outside of Africa. The other really brief point, just with yours, it's outside my area of law, but I do as an American. One thing I would say about that case is so interesting is that if you look at American law under that particular statute, they've specifically said non-state actors cannot be held civilly responsible for these kinds of acts. So implicitly, that court had to recognize Palestine as a state under jurisprudence of that particular statute to even award damages in favor of the plaintiffs. So, ironic, I don't think that was an intended outcome, but it's interesting to recognize that that is one of the kind of ironies of that case.
Thanks.
Yes. I thought you would be more forceful on the legitimacy of the ICC question. I mean, when I hear words of legitimacy and expectations, I'm always very wary, because it's whose legitimacy perception, whose expectations, and I never know how to use the word legitimacy. I actually tell my students not to use the term because they don't know how to use it, and even those who are specialists in it usually don't know how to use it, in my view. But so the usefulness of the ICC in answering tough questions, I don't know. I mean, we have to go back to what the function of the ICC is. You know, if it's been given, I know Mark will possibly agree to some extent on this, but it depends what we want it to do. You know, do we really want it to settle international disputes of the hardest international disputes? No. It's there supposedly to end impunity for international crimes. I think it's a flawed project, but that's another roundtable we should have. And you said it will be useless. I think it already is to a large extent, but again, that's another discussion. So we've put too much hope in this, and you know, I don't see it. Even answering the question about the borders of Palestine or Palestine as a state would really make that much of an impact. It's, I think, often mostly irrelevant. To link the questions of what it means for the court as well, and the last question, I think it's difficult to tell, because nobody mentioned the Comoros issue, which was dealt with recently, you know, where you have this referred by Comoros, formerly by Comoros, and that was rejected by the OTP. So it's difficult to say whether they want this or not. I mean, I think they had legitimate reasons to reject it, on gravity reasons, but also the people who contest it also have a legitimate reason to say it could have gone forward on other jurisdictional grounds. I think gravity is a joke. So on the one hand, Bensouda is saying she wants this. On the other hand, you know, she rejects a Comoros claim, which was one way into the situation, even a small kind of could have been a test case. You have Kevin saying they don't want this. You have interviews saying that they might have more people on it. So I would side with Kevin on this, to be honest, that I think the ICC doesn't want this as an institution, and the OTP really wants to look good that it's looking into it, but probably doesn't want to start anything formal anytime soon.
Thanks, Dov.
On the framing question, I mean, it is pretty amazing, because I'm pretty sure Hamas is the only group other than human rights organizations who have spoken out in favor of an ICC intervention. No one else has. You know, there's leaked memos about Abbas saying that he really didn't want to do this. The Palestinian ambassador to The Hague, the City of Peace and Justice, just 2 weeks before the actual referral, called going to the ICC the final divorce, a one-way move that you couldn't go back from. The U.S. obviously called it a train wreck option and a nuclear option. Canada said that it's crossed the red line. The EU is a little bit less harsh on things but doesn't want it to happen. The ICC maybe doesn't want it to happen, but Hamas wants it to happen. And so this is weird for framing of conflicts, because it's Hamas and Human Rights Watch, basically. And that makes it pretty awkward, right? But, you know, Hamas probably has very, very little to lose, I think, with doing this. They probably understand that the case, as Kevin has suggested, probably won't go anywhere that far. They probably understand that they're to a certain degree, not going to be rehabilitated through this process. So it's probably worth trying. I don't know if that will change the conflict narrative for them or their place in it, but I think they just, my guess, and this is just speculation, that, you know, it's, you know, why not? If not, nothing particularly bad is going to happen, might as well do it. And also, I think, as well, to change the conflict narrative, as Michael has mentioned, within Palestinian politics, not just between Palestinian factions and other factions, Israeli or otherwise, but change the dynamic within between Fatah and Hamas itself. And then, in terms of the...
I'll just say a quick word on the question of legitimacy and Hamas also. First, I guess, I was seeing it could go either way, right? That it's possible that that the motivation could have been to increase the legitimacy of Hamas or to diminish it on the part of the PA. I don't think Hamas wins from this either way. I'm not at all persuaded. It is true what Mark says, that they've articulated support for the ICC. I'm not persuaded that goes many layers down. I don't know whether that's rhetoric meant for public consumption or whether that's actually what the feeling is. What I'm curious about is, you know, what the motivation was on the part of PA with respect to their unity government with Hamas. Because it strikes me that for better or for worse, it's very unlikely that a serious peace process that the U.S. is backing, without the U.S. backing a peace process that isn't going to be serious, will move forward so long as Hamas controls Gaza. Every time I listen to any American official talk about Hamas, it seems to me that there's nothing nuanced about the vision, the perception of Hamas. So what might have, you know, one of the motivations might have been to increase the legitimacy of Hamas. If you increase the legitimacy of Hamas by subjecting it to scrutiny by the ICC and potentially changing its behavior, you just weaken Hamas. Right, because the only effective strategy it has for fighting a war is not through legitimate law of war sort of mechanisms. So you potentially weaken Hamas, and if you diminish its legitimacy from the perspective of the PA and its international legitimacy, I'm not persuaded that that will translate into diminishing its legitimacy with respect to the population that it governs and that supports it. So you end up in the sort of intractable position in either case. So when I sort of puzzle through how this could go, I don't see any good way forward, unfortunately. Sorry.
Thanks, Leslie.
Okay. My head is totally spinning. there's too much going on here. I'm totally with Dov in that I don't understand what is meant by legitimacy. It can mean anything. And likewise, I tell my students not to... With different audiences, okay, if Hamas were to disappear tomorrow as a political force, as a military force, you'd still have 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza who are going to fight back every time Israel attacks them. And whether you're leftists, rightists, Islamists, or conservatives or whatever, it doesn't really make any difference. Hamas, I think, yeah, they're happy to join the ICC. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the PFLP, all the factions... like supported the Goldstone report back in 2009 when that came out and said they were in favour of the ICC at that point. Basically, it doesn't matter. All the Hamas guys that are liable to be prosecuted are probably going to be killed by Israel beforehand. So they literally have nothing to lose. I guess that's where I see the ICC from the Palestinian perspective, from the broader Palestinian perspective, not from the PA. I think it's just, well, we literally have nothing to lose. Let's give it a go, and we'll continue with it, you know, relying on international solidarity with, you know, fighting for equality with our Israeli neighbours, and we'll see how that all goes. Chantal.
Michael, thank you.
Yeah, I must say what annoys me a little bit when we talk too much politics is that the perspective of the victims get forgotten and lost. And in this case, for me, we have to remember the perspective of the victims, and the Palestinians are the victims, and the Palestinians of Gaza, first of all. And this is why, for me, it's not a paradox that Hamas is on the same side of Human Rights Watch in asking the intervention of the ICC, because literally, for everyone who knows the situation in Gaza, who have has been living there or so, has been there for in the last years, knows that the people, the almost 2 million people there, are desperate. They have nothing left, and Hamas is part of the people living in Gaza, and not only. So for me, when Dov says, what is the function of the ICC, and we have to go back to that, and you said, it's not a court to fix international controversy. But we are not talking about an international controversy here. We are talking about ending impunity, ending more than 50 years of grave crimes that have been committed against the Palestinian people. And this, for me, is the function of the ICC.
Okay, thank you for bearing with us. We did finish a little late, but I'm sure that you can appreciate that. I want to let all of the panellists come back in. I want to say thank you for a tremendously rich discussion. It's very, very rare to get a blend of expertise and real seriousness of law, of politics, and of ethics. So it's been a treat to see you discussing this, and very difficult not to interject myself, but I will do so later. So I want to thank the panellists, but before I do, let me just let you know that there will be, I hope, a podcast of the event available via the Centre for International Studies website and the LSE Experts website. And we're also trying to persuade some or all of the panellists to contribute to a symposium on the blog Justice in Conflict on these issues. So look out for that in the next few days. But thank you for bearing with us. Thank you for your excellent questions. And please join me now in thanking the panellists for a really fantastic panel.